Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 2000, includes Daniel Klein, Associate Professor of Economics at Santa Clara University, and Professor David Henderson, Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution, discussing whether or not economists can reach a conclusion. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe and stop by each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
So David, when I was told we would be having a conversation, which is always nice, I knew that whether economists reach a conclusion, whether economists agree on things would be something that you would have a lot of insight into because you've dealt with so many economists and you're in touch with a lot of the policy work that economists do.
Right.
I brought along your wonderful book. I use many of the entries in here in my teaching, by the way, The Fortune Encyclopedia of Economics, which covers, I don't know, maybe 20, 25 policy areas, policy topics.
Yeah, at least, yeah.
Mostly all written by economists.
Right.
This book reaches a conclusion, but this book isn't necessarily all of economists. And before I ask you, let me just give the background of this question. Do economists reach a conclusion? It's asking, is the old joke about economists sound? The old joke, if you laid all economists end to end, they still would not reach a conclusion. What are your feelings about economists?
I think that is something that there's something to the joke, unfortunately, but I think there's a lot more than that joke. And let me tell you the way Milton Friedman has put it at times. He says, if you put a bunch of people in a room, a bunch of economists, a bunch of non-economists, economists from across the political spectrum, non-economists from across the political spectrum, and some policy issue comes up, within 10 minutes of the discussion, all the economists are ranged on one side of the debate and all the non-economists on the other side, independent of political view or affiliation. So for example, let's say someone says, we should have a gasoline tax some economist says we should have a gasoline tax in order to discourage consumption. I might be an economist in there who says we shouldn't have a gasoline tax because it will discourage consumption and people ought to be able to consume the amount they want and not have government put this artificial barrier in there. The non-economist will say, oh, come on, a 20-cent per gallon increase in tax won't cause people to quit driving. And the economist will say, no, it won't cause people to quit driving. It'll cause them to drive a little less. And quickly you find all of the economists agreeing that whether it's good or bad, people will drive less. And most of the non-economists saying, it won't have that much impact. So there's an example where they're agreeing on the economics. They might disagree on the value conclusion.
All right. Do you think, though, that relative to, let's say, the population at large, economists tend to agree on the conclusion, the policy conclusion?
It'll vary with the policy. I think it's very hard to find, well, I know it's very hard to find an economist who's against free trade. I know it's very hard to find an economist who's in favor of rent controls. Mm-hmm. And so there are some conclusions they've reached. Mm-hmm. And I think that surprises the public in general when you find that out.
Yeah. And sometimes economists disagree, although they might actually agree on the economics, like you were saying, in a
right.
sense. A couple years ago, and in fact, you were there, I'm pretty sure, several years ago at the AEA,
yes.
Solow was debating Barrow.
Yes.
Robert Solow was debating Robert Barrow.
And I remember you there, too.
Yeah.
Asking your question about schools.
Yeah. In the course of it, Solow had said he doesn't find any of the school reform proposals appealing. During Q&A, I asked him, why don't you find school vouchers appealing? And he said it's not for any economics reasons. All the economics run in favor of that reform. But rather, it's because what made me, Robert Solow, an American, was the United States Army and the U.S. public school system.
I remember that.
And I guess he kind of agrees with what the economists would normally say about the reform proposal, but he thinks that the government ought to be somehow making us Americans through their public school system.
Yeah, yeah, and so that is a good instance where he agrees on the analysis but doesn't agree on the policy conclusion because of other values he brings into it.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting though, Solow on many issues has, well, let's put it this way, Solow and I agree on many issues. For example, if you asked him what's the impact of the minimum wage, he would say it puts out of work the most vulnerable, the least skilled workers. If you then asked him, should we raise the minimum wage, he'd say, huh? Did you hear what I just said?
Uh-huh.
I think that's true.
Would he say, let's abolish it? If he had I don't think he would say it in public because he's Robert Solo. But if he had to push a button and have the responsibility of not having abolished it by not pushing a certain button, you think he would?
And the option isn't to lower it by a dollar an hour, but it's either abolish or leave it the same?
Yeah.
I think he probably would.
Abolish it.
I think he would. I'm not positive.
Yeah, I don't know either.
But I'll tell you, in fact, what made me come up with the idea for the Fortune Encyclopedia of Economics was that I was working at the Council of Economic Advisors in the early 1980s. And two of my colleagues there were Paul Krugman and Larry Summers. Marty Feldstein had hired them, and Murray Weidenbaum had hired me and then quit. And Marty inherited me, although he rehired me later when he had a chance to get rid of me, he didn't. But anyway, we would sometimes have lunch, they and Ben Zeiker and Lincoln Anderson, and a number of other economists and I. And what I noticed in our discussions at lunch was just how often we agreed, how we saw the world roughly the same way, just as far as what the facts are and what are the implications of certain policies, whether or not we favored the policies. So we all agreed, for example, that if you raise unemployment insurance benefits, the unemployment rate is going to go up. And the question is how much? And even there was some agreement. And I thought, you know, economics seems to be ready to be called a science or something close to a science. It should have an encyclopedia.
Uh-huh.
And I just stored that thought, didn't do anything with it for 9 years, and then Warner Books came along and asked me to do one, and I'd had that thought and had developed it in mentally up in my brain, if not on paper. And so what I was able to do was I was able to find economists who were experts in their various areas, who had said something important in their areas, and have them write that. And so what you'll find in that book is it really does represent the mainstream opinion within the particular issue they're writing about.
Uh-huh. That's an very important qualification.
Right.
Within the particular issue.
Right.
I find, because if you take some issue, let's say the FDA.
Right.
You can't find any economists who say kind things about the FDA. Have you ever found any?
No, and I'll tell you an interesting story about that, but I want to hear your point, and then I'll tell you my story.
I mean, this question, do economists reach a conclusion? One way to answer that, try to answer that, is through, for example, those surveys that are done of economists.
Right.
And they ask all economists, what do you think about the FDA?
Right.
Some of them say they like it.
Right.
Imperfect information, consumer protection, I think it's a good thing.
Right.
But the more important question, and this is why I'm a little bit more bullish on the idea that economists do reach a conclusion, if you ask the most qualified economists in that field, at least for some issues, this isn't
right.
for all issues, you get a much stronger consensus, I think, in favor of, you know, freedom of contract and
right.
private property and
right.
those
getting
kinds
rid
of policies.
The FDA's restrictive policies.
There's
on
tons
drugs.
Of economists who make those statements about the FDA.
Right.
None on the other side.
Almost, right.
You know, you sometimes get, you know, I can find quotations, for example, from Jerome Rothenberg, and actually from Krugman, who in passing kind of say something that might be vaguely favorable.
To the FDA.
But they are not economists who have worked on it.
Yeah, they haven't studied it.
Right.
Right.
So if you look at the ones who really think through it a little more responsibly, they reach more of a conclusion.
And in fact, I'll tell you how an interesting thing that happened early in this process. Fortune assigned an editor not to edit, but rather to kind of look at the stuff that I was turning out, that my authors were turning out. And I sent her the first 20 articles as I was going along relatively early in the process. And then I was going to be in New York. And so I visited her. We had lunch. And she was troubled by a couple of the articles because I had told her this was going to be a mainstream book representing the mainstream viewpoint. The one that bugged her like crazy was the one on job safety. And she said, I can't believe this guy's saying that you really don't need the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA. He seems like he's saying the market works. There's implicitly a market for job safety. I've never heard that before. And she said, are you sure this is a mainstream view? And my answer was, if you ask the typical economist what he thinks about it, he won't necessarily say what Kip Viscusi, the author, said.
Right.
But if you give him Kip Viscusi's article and let him sit with it half an hour and then ask him what he thinks about it, he'll agree with Kip Viscusi.
Right.
And so I think
And especially if he has an opportunity to have some conversation with somebody familiar.
Right.
If he's got any doubts.
Right.
Yeah.
And see, here's where I think a lot of modern economics goes really wrong. Because the way I'd put it is that a lot of modern economics is full of what I would call possibility theorems.
Right.
It's possible that. And then they take certain assumptions and they prove that under those very restrictive assumptions, this is going to go wrong in the market. And this other thing, under very restrictive assumptions about how government acts, namely, they're just out for the public good, they're very smart, they're virtually omniscient, they're a god.
Right.
Under those assumptions, the government will do better. And that's unfortunately, a lot of what economics today is.
Yeah.
Joe Stiglitz is one of the most extreme in that respect. He can prove that, you know, you should have this government regulation and that government regulation, and it's all in his assumptions. I don't think Joe, I'm not positive this, but I can't recall that Joe has ever done an empirical article, that he's ever looked carefully at data for one of his articles in his life. I'm not sure, but I think that that's true, and if it's not, it's very close to true.
I can't give any counterexamples.
Yeah.
It's my impression as well.
Yeah.
In his textbook, he's got kind of a sidebar on school reform.
Yeah.
Very non-committal, as you'd expect, ultimately, but he more or less frowns on the idea of school vouchers, bringing up arguments about, like, well, parents wouldn't know enough to pick the right school.
Yeah, yeah, right. Like, and, of course, they're feeding their kids. They're sending their kid to a doctor.
Right.
And somehow they managed to get them through preschool.
Yeah.
But man, when they turn 5.5 years old, boom, they turn into idiots.
And those bureaucrats, they really have a great idea where to send my kid to school and what to do for them.
Right. By the way, I want to just point out that even though I think the arguments, those kinds of arguments against vouchers are bad arguments, there are, I think, good arguments against vouchers. And as a result of those arguments, I'm no longer in favor of vouchers.
Because the strings attached.
I think what we would have after 5 or 10 years of vouchers is slightly better public schools with lots of strings and a much more weakened private school sector.
Let's digress on that a minute.
Okay.
We got to get back. I want to get back. But it seems to me that there's a safety valve, and that's that if, in fact, the strings attached are onerous, and degrade the quality of the school and so on, there would remain the option for the private school to say, we don't redeem vouchers and we don't have the strings attached.
There would be that option. I think that, though, that it shrinks the number of those kinds of options available. It's an economies of scale issue. My wife and I send our daughter to a private school. I'm not sure when this is going to be shown, but I'm not totally happy with this private school. We look around and we say, well, what else do we have? And there aren't a whole lot of choices. You don't have a lot of degrees of freedom with private schools. If you then reduce the number of them by half because other people don't find those restrictions very onerous, it makes it very onerous, it makes it even harder to have that satisfaction of the consumer in the existing private schools left.
Just so the safety valve isn't enough to save the proposal.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's another point I want to make, and that is two points. A lot of why people think economists don't agree is because the following thing happens. A reporter goes out to do a piece on free trade. It isn't hard to find an economist who will favor it. It's not even hard to find an economist who's articulate about it. So they do that. And then their old journalism school kicks in and they say, I better have a well-rounded article, so I better talk to an economist who opposes free trade. Well, if John Culbertson at University of Wisconsin is out that day, they can't find one. So they look around and they try to find someone who's against free trade. And they work their way through the list. At best, they find an economist who's at the AFL-CIO. But sometimes they can't even get too much out of that person because that person kind of knows that free trade's pretty good too. So they find someone else at the AFL-CIO, or they find someone at the National Association of Manufacturers, or they find someone at a firm being threatened by imports, and the person is some kind of analyst or whatever, has never taken a degree in economics, has never taught economics, isn't what you usually think of as an economist, but is speaking on an economic issue, and they will say, this economist believes that. In other words, they will decide that this person saying this is an economist. And that's often what happens. And then the headline will be economists disagree. Mm-hmm. It's not economists disagree, it's two people disagreed. One was an economist and one wasn't.
Or as you say, they do find the one, the rare minority economist to actually take the position.
Yeah,
to actually serve in the interview or the
and story. It looks like equal, and they give equal time, even though it's like 99-1.
Right.
So that kind of thing happens.
How about the minimum wage? You know, Card and Kruger.
Right.
David Card and Alan Kruger got a lot of publicity about empirical findings that when New Jersey and elsewhere had increases in the minimum wage, employment did not go down, and in fact, in some cases, they even had findings that it went up.
Right.
Do they ever really, though, say that they're in favor of the minimum wage?
I think they don't.
I think they don't.
And I remember reading David Card saying something interesting on this. He said, "I would never take a policy position on an issue I do research on." And I thought, he's making it sound like that's a really neat kind of moral stand to take. And I'm thinking, how weird. You spend your whole life becoming an expert on something, and you don't care enough to take a policy position on it? What kind of a human being are you? What kind of a citizen are you? and so, but now Kruger was the chief economist at the Department of Labor under Robert Reich. And so I would be real curious, because he had to take some kind of position on it internally. I don't know what position he took.
I wouldn't be surprised if they both are sympathetic to the minimum wage, but they don't actually say it in print.
No, they don't. You're right.
And even in their book.
Yeah.
There is an economist. I found an article by an economist in favor of the minimum wage by an economist named Charles Crapo.
How do you spell the last name?
Craypo. I'm quite sure, at Notre Dame University in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
And there was a book about taking sides, and it was like just like you said, one for, one against, and it kind of makes it look like it's 50-50. You know, the article, a lot of it amounted to saying, well, perfect competition is science fiction. And so none of that matters.
Yeah, right.
You know?
The standard kind of B+ undergrad conclusion, you spend half the quarter talking about perfect competition. We all know that applies about the wheat market and not much else. And so nothing else applies to anything.
Right, vitiates the whole, all the points, all the arguments.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that's a reason, by the way, not to spend half the quarter on perfect competition and to talk more generally about how markets really work.
Right.
I think a whole lot of students nowadays go through economics without ever hearing the name Schumpeter, understanding his idea of creative destruction. And interestingly, I just wrote a piece for Red Herring, a long article on antitrust, in which I pointed out that you open they edited this out. But anyway, you open Posner's book on antitrust, and you look in the index under Schumpeter, it ain't there. I bet Posner's never read Schumpeter. And it's interesting, all these people who are critical of antitrust didn't ever really read Schumpeter in the 60s and 70s. Side issue, but it does kind of show up how narrow economists are sometimes on some of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
The other point I wanted to make, unless you were going to go somewhere.
No, I was going to ask, make a comment about Card not taking a position?
Yes.
You know, I'm sure he thinks of that as some sort of like scientific objectivity.
Yeah, he made that clear in the context, yes.
And I just want to, you know, that's junk. I mean,
he
really does have feelings and positions about it. He really is a human being who goes out and argues at cocktail parties and votes in the voting booth.
Yeah.
And he's only disguising something about himself. He's only withholding something about himself.
Yeah.
He's not maintaining some mystical objectivity that
I mean, he has to have some position. Even if he never tells anyone, he must have some thought on it.
Right.
And if he doesn't have a thought, whoa.
Yeah. And if he does, why not put it on the table?
Right. And by the way, one of the things I was told early in my teaching by various senior people around me is don't tell them much about your political views. Don't tell them much about where you're coming from. Well, you know, I would be a horrible poker player. I just, I can't do that.
Yeah.
Even if I never tell them my views, the C student in the class is going to figure out after 2 weeks, I kind of like free markets. I don't really like government very much. And so over the years, I decided, well, that's kind of obvious and it's kind of silly not to. So yeah. I will typically the first day or two of class, I'll just, when the context is right, I'll just tell them basically what I believe in a nutshell. And what I've had on my student evaluations uniformly from everyone, including the people who I would guess not all of them agree with me, is it was so refreshing to have a professor who admits where he's coming from politically and who tells that, who shares it, who doesn't try to disguise it, and who seems to care enough about the issue to have a political position.
Right.
It's never come back and bit me.
Yeah, I've had a similar experience.
Yeah.
It's amazing how few, I think, teach that way.
Yeah.
And really approach research that way, too.
Yeah, but. Yeah. Well, you know, related to that, I won an award called the Shieflin Teaching Award at the Naval Postgraduate School, where I teach, as well as being a Hoover person. And it's for the best teacher that year on campus kind of thing. And the students get to choose it. And it's also students who graduated who get a say about it, who are out in the field, have been out there for a few years. And I got to give a talk at the event where it was awarded on teaching. And I sent told about my philosophy of teaching and why I'm passionate about teaching. And I sent a copy to a fellow good teacher, Russell Roberts at Washington University in St. Louis. And I got an interesting email back. He said, isn't it interesting that the vast majority of us academics spend most of our working life teaching, and we don't talk about it much with each other, and we don't seem to try really hard, except for a few of us, to hone our skills and really get good and actually enjoy it? Isn't it strange in a world that's not that doesn't have third world poverty, we're not starving economists, isn't it strange that we don't just enjoy it? And I do. I gather you do from everything I've heard.
And so many of the economists, they think of themselves as scientists, as economists. When they turn in their W-2s, like, or their 1040s, just like we did, what are they? They're college teachers.
Yeah.
You know, their profession
is
college teachers.
Yeah. And in fact, sometimes when I'm trying to talk to someone who I think might have some kind of class issue about my saying I'm a professor, and I'm trying to have a discussion, I don't want that to get in the way, and they ask me what I do, I say I'm a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You were going to go to another point?
Yeah, I think one of the other reasons that people get this idea that don't get a feel for how close to unanimous economists are on so many issues is that often on the issue in which economists would be unanimous, no one is paying them to research it. So, for example, mm-hmm. you have people in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. and other places who want to do cornrow braiding. They need to get a license to do that. To get the license, they have to take all this stuff about the use of chemicals. They don't use chemicals, so it's not teaching them how to do it. And they're saying, why should I get this license? And some of them are fighting it, and they've got an organization called the Institute of Justice helping them out. If you laid that out and asked economists, what do you think of it? I don't know one, except probably a fairly sadistic person, who would say they ought to do that. They ought to be required to do that. But you won't get that idea because these people are working in very tight margins. They're not going to come up with $20,000 to pay an economist to do a study. And so there's another bias there.
That's right.
And you know, that's a kind of a bias that happens all over the place. You can mm-hmm. find a firm, for example, that is going to be hurt by imports, and they might pay you $20,000 to $50,000 to do a study showing why we should have import restrictions. But you won't find the consumers, all of whom are going to pay an extra $3 for a pair of shoes, to come up with the money to pay you to do that study. So there's a bias there too.
That's a very good point. And it gets back to the unseen and the dispersed benefits of freedom.
Right.
And no interest group. It's not easy to organize to inform that group of beneficiaries to be vocal on it.
Right. And even if they were vocal, they're sure not going to, you know, 10,000 of them aren't going to spend $3 each sending you money to research it.
And occupational licensing is another one which I've looked into some.
Yes, that's right.
It's a consensus
Yeah.
I mean, there's one guy, you know, Robert Evans.
Yeah, I know the name.
I think he's a Canadian economist. And I think, like you, and he, I can find a quote where he is kind of not enthusiastic about, or he kind of plays the other side, but.
Yeah. Is he an academic or is he?
I'm pretty sure he is, but I'm not, you know, I don't know that well.
Yeah.
But, you know, everything else, it's on occupational licensing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we have it.
Yeah. And the FDA, as you mentioned, although the FDA story I was going to tell was really the first economist to look closely at the FDA and how they restrict, they slow down the development and introduction of new drugs was Sam Peltzman, who was my professor at UCLA, and when I was a graduate student. And I was there when Sam was doing the study. And he was called to testify before Senator Gaylord Nelson's committee on his research. And Nelson had contacted two economists who he figured, I think, he had in his pocket, or his staff had contacted them, to kind of shoot holes in Peltzman's research, which they came and did. But they were very, especially one of them, Stanley Labergott, who was a Department of Labor economist previously, very independent man. He was, and then he went to Wellesley. Labergott, you know, laid out criticism, but kind of the way you would do in an academic seminar. Well, you might have tried this variable, or you might have, you know, that kind of thing. And it clearly wasn't where Nelson hoped he would go. And I've actually got the testimony. I read through it all. I've kind of forgotten the details. It's been about 10 years since I last read it. But I remember that at one point, Nelson jumped on something Sam Peltzman had said about how you don't have. Well, actually, it was the famous case in the early 60s, that drug that people got,
thalidomide.
He said, Sam should not have said this, but this was Sam. Sam said, he was just egged on to say it in an interview with BBC, I think. So you're saying, Professor Peltzman, that we don't have enough thalidomide tragedies? In other words, that we're way or erring on the side of too few tragedies and way fewer good effects. And Sam never should have taken that one, but he did. And he said, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, Nelson used that and just quoted it, and, you know, this is terrible. And Labergott comes in and says, no, you misunderstand. You got to understand what he's saying. He's not saying we ought to have more thalidomide. He's saying we ought to have more drugs allowed. And every once in a while, there will be that kind of tragedy. But the lives lost, the problems caused by that are going to be way less than the problems solved by this other thing. And so even there, I mean, this guy didn't even have to do that, but he did it. And that's the sense in which I mentioned Friedman earlier about, you know, what Friedman said. You get economists in a room and suddenly this kind of professional ethic of, well, you know, I know that's not true, or I know that is true. That kind of comes in, and that's exciting for me. That's why I have, you know, a reasonable amount of optimism about economists in the right context. And unfortunately, they often are not in the right context.
Yeah. Let me ask you about Paul Krugman. You said you were his colleague.
Yes.
And now he's often putting out positions, conclusions in the press, and do you find you take exception to those sometimes?
Well, sometimes, yes. Now, what's interesting, though, is how often I do agree with him. He had a piece the other day on the Microsoft trial that I thought was excellent, just talking about really how horrible this is, that you take one of the most successful firms in history, and these trial lawyers and state attorneys general and so on are trying to take it down and just grab that wealth for themselves or their constituents. And he said, I'm really, really nervous about where this country's heading. Huh. That was Krugman, I think, at his most passionate recently.
That was neat.
That's great. Also, another thing he did, which I thought was really neat, was when the WTO thing, all the riots in Seattle, where he pointed out in I think it was in his New York Times column, that I think it was in Slate magazine, the web magazine. He pointed out that here you have the people who were critical of WTO had an ad, a full page ad in the New York Times, in which the pictures they showed, the things they wanted to avoid, were giving third world people the option of having the kind of lifestyle that you and I have in this country. Nice houses, refrigerators, cars that work,
and that the protesters food. Have.
Yeah, the protesters have, right. And I thought he did a beautiful job on laying bare their, at minimum, hypocrisy, and at worst, just outright cruelty to these starving, suffering people. I thought he was great on that.
Cool.
I think there are other things. I mean, you know, yeah, I do have my disagreements with him. But when he's actually doing the economic analysis, as opposed to maybe just giving a throwaway line,
yeah.
Well, I better satisfy all the liberals who live next door to me in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. You know, when he's not doing that, I pretty much agree with mm-hmm. him. Mm-hmm. I mean, 80% of the time. Yeah.
I can think of something he wrote recently. He made a very nice juxtaposition of the attitudes about dietary supplements versus the attitudes about biotechnology. Do you remember this one?
No.
And he made a very good point that, you know, you have all these activists against biotechnology because it's unnatural, and they're all in favor of dietary supplements because it's natural.
Right.
But meanwhile, the benefits of biotechnology are overwhelming and the potentials are great. But he said, and this kind of completed his story, and this is where I didn't really agree, but meanwhile, these dietary supplements probably need to be regulated by the FDA. And it wasn't really the thrust of the article, but it was sort of one of these throwaway hints or insinuations.
Yeah, and if you said to him, Paul, give me your evidence that we need to do this, my guess is he wouldn't have any. You know, it was a throwaway line. I see part of it is Paul is trying to position himself. He's trying to position himself as the moderate. You know, you want the real truth, don't go to those extreme guys like Henderson or Klein or, you know, that kind of thing. Don't go to those extreme guys on the other side like, I'm trying to think who nowadays, like Robert Kuttner, by the way, who's not an economist, or people like that. Come to me, I'm the one who...
Sure.
Who's going to give you the straight
no,
stuff.
I applaud him. It's great. And it's great that he takes part in public discourse. That's what we want economists, we hope economists will do.
Right. And by the way, I think when he won the John Bates Clark Medal, the medal given to the best economist in the last few years under age 40, at the time he was really cranking up his writing, his popular writing. And I remember talking to Sylvia Nasso of the New York Times, who's a big fan of his, and her saying, you know, I think that was to some extent a signal that they were sending, that they'd kind of like economists to get back into the conversation too. I mean, you've got all these policy issues going on. You've got all these economists who, if they take a little time to learn how to write, a little time to learn how to speak, would do better than 90%+ of the people who are doing it, who maybe know how to speak but don't know what to speak, and we aren't hearing their viewpoint.
Right. I guess on Krugman, the one other way you might fault him is that there are a lot of issues, like just the basic FDA issue,
right?
That he could come down hard with a standard kind of economist, this is not useful regulation line, pile of research and evidence, and just drive that home. But he does not do that.
Right.
He kind of more dances around the sort of middle issues, and he leans that way. But
right.
Yeah, but you're you know.
But that's his position. That's the ground he's staked out.
Yeah, yeah.
His whole, at least he perceives, I think, and I'm just guessing here, but I think he perceives that his whole income, his whole strategy, his whole career for the next 20 years are based on that.
And it might be the best thing for society.
He might be right.
Yeah.
Right.
No, but besides his income and his career, it might be the best thing for society, because if he started just smashing the FDA, even though what he said was perfectly sound, the New York Times might say, you're out of here.
That's right. There is an optimal amount of that. And I write for Fortune a lot, and I've kind of figured that out. You know, I would love to write a piece. Actually, I bet Fortune would open. I was going to say, I'd love to write a piece saying that we should end the drug war and legalize drugs. And I was going to say, but Fortune wouldn't go for that. But, you know, actually, I think we're actually close to the point where Fortune might go for that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think we're at a point with the drug war similar to where we were with Prohibition the last couple of years, where you have these outrageous things the government is doing. Jailing people who have cancer and want to use marijuana for the pain. Jailing people who are in wheelchairs. In Arizona, there was a case recently, who are using marijuana and have small amounts on their property. confiscating people's assets, shooting innocent people by mistake, breaking into people's houses, and they got the wrong house. Oh well, too bad. You have that on the one hand. You have more and more people on the other hand talking about this and saying, you know, maybe we should reconsider this. And so I think we could be with the drug war in a similar position where we were with the war on alcohol, the other drug, back in the early 30s, and then Prohibition ended. And I remember, I think it was Milton Friedman who once pointed out that no one really anticipated Prohibition was going to end that quickly, but it did. Mm-hmm. And there's another example, by the way. Who is going to finance a study on the drug war? And actually, there are some foundations now doing that, but those aren't very many, because you know it's just the people who are hurt are just dispersed and they don't get together and do that.
Yeah, and plus they're just going to look like people who want to get high.
Yeah, right, right.
I guess when you peel away some of the complications, there's more reason to believe the joke is wrong.
No, I think the joke is absolutely wrong. I think in their journal articles, they often don't reach conclusions. But
they don't reach conclusions. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Even one of them doesn't
even
reach
one
a conclusion,
of them
much less
reach
the string of them.
Right. And actually, I just want to point out one thing about that. I remember an economist friend of mine, Alan Reynolds, once said, you know, if you want to read the interesting version of the article that appeared in the Journal of Political Economy or the American Economic Review, and it's a publication of the National Bureau of Economic Research, get the original NBER paper, because it's got all the interesting footnotes, it's got the interesting stories, all those things that get edited out, and they were the things that helped make the article. And so one economist in an article will often not reach conclusions, let alone a bunch of them.
Yeah.
But put them together and they're over a beer and ask them some of these things, and they will.
Oh. Well, maybe if we're fortunate, the conclusions, I think they're right, we're right, will be more heard, and maybe society, in fact, will get us into the conversation.
Well, I'm working on it.
I know you are. You're doing a great job.
Thanks. And you are too.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, Dan.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.